Darkly Splendid Abodes, the official podcast of Toronto the Libra, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Divination can be a means of obtaining guidance from forces beyond oneself. But even if one chooses the psychological model of the universe, it can suggest insights not readily available to the conscious mind. The following workshop, presented as part of an ongoing monthly series in Toronto, explores the divination methods of tarot, the Yi Ching, and of geomancy.
First and foremost, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. So this is one of a series of practical magic workshops that we've been doing through Toronto Kaliva. Toronto Kaliva is a loose organization and just social group for people local to Toronto who are interested in occultism, magic, and specifically the school of thought, Kaliva. We've been doing these presentations for about a year and a half. We've covered everything from astral projection, vanishing, invocation, invoking magic, and much more. And today we're here to talk about divination. I will briefly talk about some essential perspectives on divination, or things that I find essential, and then I'll break down three specific forms of divination, being the tarot, the I Ching, and geomancy. Before I get into the specifics of those, though, the scope of this presentation will ultimately be on practical magic. This is intended for practicing occultists, magicians, pagans, however you may call yourself. This is not intended to cover the wealth of history, and even really give a complete description of these systems, but to give enough of a foundation and to give some perspectives that I find useful in using these systems for the practice of magic. To start, there are three main uses to the practicing magician for divination, for any in all of these forms. The first is guidance. I think that's going to be quite obvious. When we think of divination or the use of an oracle, we think of receiving some kind of message to help us make decisions and act in the world. The second is interpretation, which really is not simply to get guidance on a decision, but to help understand ourselves, the situation, the divine, whatever it may be. And the third is meditation, less commonly used in the obvious sense of divination, where we go to use it for these purposes, but to actually take it away from a specific query we may have, and rather to use it to understand still some component of ourselves, but in a more abstract and potentially universal way. I think an important place to start on the subject of guidance, that first point, and really of all these points, is the big question of, is divination real? And this is often a question closely tied to the big one of, is magic real? To the practicing magician, of course, we would presumably believe in magic to some degree. You might take a psychological approach, you might take a more spiritual approach to that answer. But in the first place, we use divination as a form of guidance to get a message from somewhere, something, potentially outside of ourselves. That could be the universe, generally, or some other name for that. That could be something we call God, or from a Thelemian perspective, that might be the Holy Guardian Angel. And that could also be a specific spirit, deity, entity, which you have called upon to answer a question which you believe it may know. And beyond all these points, and this question of, well, are spirits real or whatever, of course, again, to the practicing magician, the odds are you may say yes. But the more valuable, and actually in many ways the more Thelemic perspective, is does this add value? Can I use this in my own work? Can I use this to supplement my magical practice and to help me act in the world? And that's where we bring in the sort of scientific skepticism that Crowley favored, and that's common among Polemites, or should be, in that even if it really is spirits or whatever else, if it's not adding value, then actually you probably shouldn't be using it. But if you can suspend your disbelief for a moment, or at least enter the practice of divination with the openness to see if you can extract that value actually does come first in helping you achieve your goals. And those goals, of course, to a practicing magician or a practicing mystic, might be spiritual attainment, might be understanding oneself or the world or the divine, and so on. But whatever your objective may be, ultimately you just have to figure out, can this help me get there? And ultimately, and we'll see, and I'll bring this up several times, the question really is, or the point really is, to actually simply try and see if you can extract that value. So to return to the point of guidance, wherever it is coming from, whether you intended to be from a specific source, or are simply opening yourself up to allow an answer to come through from somewhere, or even letting it just be pure randomness, and just believing it's your own mind's ability to draw patterns and get some value, you might find that you can get genuine answers to those questions. And that's, again, the most common function of divination. I think that's what most people come to the practice with. And I think historically what we see often is, should I take this job? You know, should I proceed with this course of action? Should I lead if, should I run a society a certain way? And so on. And through the various methods I point out, I'll describe minor differences in the voice of the oracles. You will find that different oracles, and so to speak, different forms of divination, will actually carry different voices and be better or worse, potentially, at answering certain questions for you. And that's exactly why I've chosen three specific forms of divination. A, to give examples and a foundation where you can explore and take that step to try the one that speaks to you, but also to find the best forms of divination, which is the best tools for specific objectives. Practicing magic brings us, almost by definition, or very often, into brand new territories, brand new experiences. We get exposed to forces which have either been hidden within ourselves or the world, or are completely new to us, and potentially to the world. And that's where the second piece of divination comes in, which is that component of interpretation. When we do magic, to a degree by definition, we are engaging with certain forces, or that's the magical answer at least. You may call that engaging with parts of yourself, fine. But we're engaging with certain forces which are bathed in symbolism. The answers to magic are rarely as clear and hard as, this is a table in front of me. Or it may well be a table, but the question is, what does this table mean in my current circumstances? And by engaging in a symbolic medium of communication, which is any form of divination really, we're able to speak on the language of those forces and therefore interpret them according to the systems of that specific oracle. And this is especially important where we are actively looking for or actively bringing ourselves into ordeals. That is, in the practice of magic, especially if we're interested in some kind of mysticism, some kind of spiritual attainment or growth, that takes us outside of ourselves, and that exposes us to challenges where we actually may have difficulty in knowing the next thing to do. And that's where we return and lean on the oracle to help guide us, ideally, potentially, from some divine source, to actually help us get through that ordeal in the best way, or the way that's best for us in that moment. And doing so, we develop a language. We learn not just to hear the voice of that specific oracle, but to communicate back with it, and of course to communicate with those very same forces that I described. And so if you find a spirit out in the wild, or you're going through some particular ordeal, you have these tools to say, what am I going through in the moment, or how should I approach this challenge, or what is the nature of this spirit, or even of this person, for that moment in my life, or in general. And we have the ability to actually get answers back from that. And that's something, of course, tried and tested through your own work, through your own use of divination, but eventually, and ideally, you should actually be able to find the answers, to find that guidance, and that's when you will come to appreciate that value, and why it's such an important key, in my opinion, to the practicing magician. And the third point is, as a form of divination, as a form of meditation, where we may not necessarily be going through some ordeal or have some particular query to pose to a spirit, to the divine, to the universe, or even just to ourselves, but we may want to explore some part of ourselves or the world or the divine that we're not yet familiar with, to unlock that part of ourselves and be able to engage with it. And so I will point out similarly through, I'm going to drop here, so I'm pointing here, I will point out similarly through the various methods of divination, the ways in which we can actually meditate on the oracles, to actively go out of our way to engage with those forces. Not simply to passively be in a situation and try and interpret it or ask for guidance, but to jump right into those forces and immerse ourselves in them. So starting with tarot. I think that's probably one of the most common forms of divination that we'll all be familiar with. And I think it's worth noting at this point that odds are, in respect to the scope of this conversation, odds are some of you or all of you may be much better at me than any of these forms of divination or all of them than I am. And so the purpose is not, again, to say, here's the right way and the only way to do tarot, but here's enough that if not familiar, you can get started. Here's the way that I, as a practicing magician, use this tool to help me. And so for those who don't know, the tarot is a set of 78 cards, which historically didn't even begin as oracles, but as playing cards. And there's an extremely rich history of tarot and the decks and how it's evolved to where it is today. But within the Hermetic tradition, we ascribe the 78 cards in the tarot deck to Kabbalistic correspondences, Hermetic Kabbalistic correspondences. Very quickly, the Kabbalah is a, or the Hermetic Kabbalah, I should say, but the Hermetic Kabbalah is an appropriated system set from traditional Jewish mysticism, which through the Renaissance and up until today, but chiefly with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in the late 19th and 20th century, was used for practical magic, for calling upon angels, for taking oneself through a series of grades that purportedly lead to attainment. And through the Golden Dawn, and through the most popular deck, probably the most popular tarot deck, which was created through the Golden Dawn, was the Rider-Waite-Smith Tarot. That's the kind of common medieval symbol set that most of us probably think of when we think of the tarot. An older version, older deck, which is also very popular and beautiful, is the Tarot de Marseille. And finally, there was Aleister Crowley's tarot deck that he put together with Frieda Harris, called the Thought Deck. And we have a copy here, and at the end of this, we'll even try to do a community reading to see what we can put together based on some of the things discussed today, based on our own prior knowledge. But moving forward, we'll treat the tarot as having a one-to-one set of correspondences with the Hermetic Kabbalah, which I'll talk about. And those correspondences are going to be elements, they may be planets, they may be zodiacal signs. To break down, the suited cards, just like a regular deck of cards, there are suits, which typically will be some variation of wands, cups, swords, and discs or pentacles. We associate these with the four classical elements, and more to the point, with the four Kabbalistic worlds, with fire at the top as the archetypal world, water right below it as a sort of world of like a blueprint, the word is escaping me right now, and below that is the world of the mind, the Ruach, the swords. Swords are airy. And finally, the world of manifestation, the earth. Within the Kabbalah, you have these four worlds, and we use those based on the suits of the cards that we draw to assess where those forces are represented. As we might know, there are 10 numbered cards amongst those four worlds. From a Kabbalistic perspective, these 10 numbers, so 8 through 10 of the tarot deck, correspond to these 10 spheres, not including that middle one. That's the Tree of Life from the Kabbalah. Each of those spheres has a principal correspondence, which is mostly planetary in nature, starting at the bottom with Earth, into the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Then we have the polar axis, which is the polar ring of the zodiac. At the very top point, the ace, we have a point of unity. In Kabbalah, that's called Kether, or the crown, and that's not too important, but it is the concentrated unity of a given element. So just from those two points, where we have four elements, or four worlds, and 10 spheres to which they can be associated, we can compute, actually, without necessarily needing to memorize those 4D cards. Instead, we just simply need to know what does the element mean, with fire being drive, water being your emotions, your subconscious, air being your rational mind, and earth being your material circumstances. Against the principal correspondences of those spheres, you can figure out this world, this element, and this sphere might mean this in my situation. Moving on from those, and still among the suits, we have 16 court cards. Typically, these would be the king, the queen, the prince, and the princess. And as a division of four, we would likely assume, actually, that these are elemental in nature, and in fact, they are. From a Kabbalistic perspective, we can call these sub-elements, which is to say, if we have the king of wands, that is fire of fire. The king of cups, fire of water, so on and so forth. And we have, therefore, a division of the elements to understand that something may be in the world of earth. It might be a discard. But if you have a king, that may very well represent a question of your drive in relation to the earth, in relation to your material circumstances. The prince, heir, might be your reasoning, your rationality, your mind, again, within the context of that world. If you have, for instance, a prince of cups, that might be applying the mind to a matter that is emotional, or some other variation among that theme. And this is something that comes out of the actual practice, and really the art, and the fact that you have to learn to speak the language of the tarot, and that you will, especially by learning the correspondences, because you start to piece those together and it becomes a very simple computation. In the Thought deck and in other decks, there are additional correspondences like titles, which are very helpful because they hint at the nature of what that combination might mean. There are even correspondences that will often give you a planet and astrological sign. It might be Jupiter in Pisces or whatever else. And again, that will point to the nature of that card. So that aside from just the raw calculation, when you just compare correspondences side to side, you have additional factors that you can draw in to help you in your conclusion. And that also means that you don't necessarily need to read tarot this way. I read tarot this way because I'm lazy. Because I learned the Kabbalah and then I found out that you could just cross-compare. And it's like, great, I don't have to learn all these cards. I just have to know 10 things, 10 spheres, 4 worlds, 4 more elements, the court cards, and the 22 trumps, or the major arcana. The 22 trumps, just as we've already seen that Kabbalistically bear correspondences for the rest of these are the paths which connect those spheres. Those paths are relational, meaning that they pertain to the nature of two spheres that they connect. So when a path connects the first to the second, that means something. And so those 22 trumps, or major arcana, also called, have again direct correspondences, which are elemental, planetary, and zodiacal, once more. And they also tell us something about that particular facet of the Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, which is a representation of ourselves, or the divine, or the world. And I pitch those three together all the time because through the practice of magic, and actually quite implied within the system of Hermetic Kabbalah, those three things are the same, or at least those three things are mapped in the same way, that we are a microcosm, we are a complete image of the divine, of the world, and that the components within us as human beings is theoretically identical with the components of something we might call God, or at least the components of the whole world. And so in learning one, in learning ourselves, this is beyond the tarot at this point, but in learning about ourselves, we might also learn something about the world, or about God, or all three. The imagery of the cards, which we have a handful of here on the table, is also extremely useful because, again, it tells us some nature and the richness of these cards. Whether in this deck, the Thoth deck, which I love because of that richness, and the artistry of Frieda Harris, or even the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, or the Marseille, again, give us hints and allow us to learn that particular deck in its own flavor, even within the greater subset or the greater category of tarot. And you will see that certain symbols pop out as you gaze upon the deck or its cards. You may find certain cards will actually grow on you, that you will see them consistently, or you may see them in different places. And we'll get in a moment to actually reading these, or how you might read these in practice, aside from just learning each individual card. There are a few formats that we will typically draw cards in. One of the more common ones that if someone's read tarot might have already seen is the Celtic Cross, where you lay cards in a certain order, and each of those cards in that position has some meaning relevant to that position. And so when you have a given card, it might represent this is a challenge you're facing, this is the way forward, and so on. Personally, again, because I'm lazy, I almost always draw three cards because it's faster, and I usually get enough to get my answer. And those three cards can be past and present future. Other times it may well be my current position and two forks. And I have no way to actually teach or tell you when it's going to be one or the other. You may prefer just one. If I'm reading three cards, this is what the three mean, that's it. But you may also feel that sometimes that order shifts according to the nature of the message, and that if you don't understand it in a certain way, you can continue to read at it and see if it makes sense to you in another way. Something I also like to do is draw a daily card. In the morning, thought for the day, the force of the day, it's the card of the day. That doesn't necessarily mean that if you draw a card called sorrow, you're going to have a terrible day. But it is something to begin with, to contemplate, and take with you, and also actually to measure against the day. Going back to that idea of skepticism, that you can actually think to yourself, does this card apply to me today? And if you do choose to read in a longer format, a longer spread, you will also learn to notice interactions between the cards. And what I mean by that is that in reading, let's say, three cards, past, present, future, it is not simply that the past is the past and it's a static card, but something about the past and something about the shift from the past to the present, or the first card to the second card, or then to the third, will relate. You may see similar themes in the imagery, similar colors, even, or similar concepts, or in fact, very different concepts. And again, the art of reading tarot, I think something that really mostly just has to be learned, because you will learn to notice different patterns and different relationships between the cards. But that will come, frankly, through practice. But that's the part that you can't really teach, or at least that I can't really teach. Because any given set of cards is going to be speaking directly to you for whatever purpose. Whether you're reading for yourself, which I think is the single most important reason to read any form of divination, or if you're reading for somebody else, and maybe your friend. Many people do it as a business. But one way or another, the cards, or the force behind the cards, are speaking to you through the cards for that purpose. And so, in fact, when we read any set of divination, we actually don't necessarily want to check out the whole background of our lives or of our subject, because the cards will be speaking to us in the way that we're going to understand. When you practice magic and speak to spirits, you will find, probably, it'll speak to you in English or the language you're comfortable with. It will speak to you in symbols and in a language that's actually familiar to you. You may have to learn that language or improve and be in the middle, but any kind of magical communication is always going to be filtered for you, and therefore you have to rely on your past experiences, your entire background, to interpret what's in front of you, even when reading for another person. The only other reason or way to read that I'd like to bring up is you may also read for special occasions. So similarly, if you want a guidance for an ensuing quarter, it's common within our tradition. At the end of these meetings and the monthly social meetings, which is the first Monday of every month, we usually do spread a read at the end, for the night, for the group, and so on. So you can apply it to any situation you may want to, whether it's for the future, whether it's for your current situation, or whether it's for the nature of that card itself. The 22 trumps, or major arcana, the Fool, the Star, the Hierophant, the Priestess, so on and so forth, I'm not going to name them all. By virtue of having direct correspondences to the paths, relate to what in our tradition is called pathworking, where you can scry, which is to magically gaze at and receive some communication or imagery or experience through, or even astral project, where you go into this space, which we believe, magically speaking, is real, either in the universe, on some other plane perhaps, or within ourselves, even as a component of ourselves. Because if we take the Tree of Life to be a representation of ourselves, therefore by traveling or scrying any of those paths through the trumps, which may just be as simple as gazing on the card, putting your mind into it until something happens, you can learn something about that part of yourself, the world, or the divine. Final point on the tarot. Alistair Crowley has an excellent book called The Book of Thoth, which he paired with the Thoth tarot deck, which explores symbolism of all these cards. And I would say any serious tarot reader, Thelema or otherwise, would greatly benefit from reading this book, especially if they use the Thoth deck. But even if they don't, because the analysis he adds, as at the very least a master of the Hermetic Kabbalah, will shed light on those cards and will help you understand it. You can read that book cover to cover, or if you draw some cards and you'd like to know more about them, you can also just treat it as an opportunity to read the specific chapter on that card and learn a little bit about it. Moving on now from tarot to the I Ching. In pretty significant contrast, the I Ching is a very old method of divination from China. The word literally means, or the two words, means the Book of Changes. And when reading the I Ching, that's actually what you would like to carry on with you, is that you are describing changes in the world, yourself, and so on. This is mostly, or almost or entirely, at least from the historical perspective, divorced from the Western Hermetic esoteric tradition, insofar as it was created and has been practiced historically in a place that doesn't give a shit about the Kabbalah or even known about it for a very long time. The place that actually developed alongside in the infancy of the Kabbalah. But nonetheless, it's an extremely useful method of divination, and my personal favorite. When I read the tarot, I'm often willing to read the tarot a lot more relaxed, in that I'll gladly read for others, and I'll even read it for what might be more frivolous reasons, or I might simply draw it and let it be, or use it to consider a current situation. I find the artistry of the cards, the imagery, has a degree of fluidity, which gives me a lot of room to interpret through time, through experience, and as a point of learning. Whereas in contrast, the I Ching I find, also known as I Ching, if that helps anyone, the I Ching gives me very firm and clear answers, and at least how I was taught to read it was to only read it if I fully intend on listening to the advice of the oracle. To the point where sometimes I want to do something, and I know I can kind of start to guess at what the answer might be, or I think the answer might be to go one way or the other. And if I think the I Ching is going to tell me not to go a certain way, I won't read it, because I don't want to read it and then ignore it. That's maybe a touch of superstition. That is the way I was taught, but it's a superstition I like. And for that reason, at the very least, I typically go to the I Ching for serious and important matters. Unlike the tarot, we don't have the same, it's not as easy to cheat and lazily learn it. And again, what I mean is that you can't just learn the Kabbalah and then save yourself the time of knowing each individual card, you can just compare correspondences. But with the I Ching, you have a set of 64 hexagrams. When we say hexagrams, we don't mean like the star, but simply a set of six lines. Those lines, from the perspective of the I Ching, are either unbroken, single straight line, which we call yang, which literally means the sun, or the sunny side, originally at least, or you have the broken line, which means the shady side. And to cast I Ching, you may throw coins to get numbers, typically three sets of coins where heads or tails is assigned to a different number, and you carve out six of these lines. As you throw the cards and the coins, I'm not going to go, you can figure out how to get the numbers and which sets of numbers mean what, but you may get changing or rather young or old lines, where you have whatever number leads to the unbroken line, but then it may also be deemed to be changing. And this is typically shown by a circle or an X for the unbroken and the broken line respectively. What this means is that while reading, the hexagram changes, literally. It represents a change in the world, in a given situation, or whatever it is you're asking the oracle about, where you convert it, according to those lines, into a second hexagram. The difficult part about this is that, again, we don't have an easy cheat sheet to read, and so most commonly you'll refer to the I Ching itself, which is really a book of the meanings of all these hexagrams. Among the best versions is the Willem Baines. You can find this online and in many bookstores, which tells you and explains the nature of each of those 64 hexagrams. And so in practically reading, you have your query, your question, which typically it's not advised to just be a yes or a no, because that has ambiguity. But I might say, what is the oracle or the outcome of this choice? And in fact, one of the ways I was taught is to ask, is to cast two sets. First to say, oracle for doing this, oracle for not doing this. And then you get clear images of the outcomes, and you ultimately pick based off how you interpret, how you read. and you look to the changing lines to tell you where is this situation going to lead into. When there are multiple changing lines, the emphasis is placed in different places. In the case of, again, you can find this online. In the case where there's one, that's the most important line for you. And the Willimane's version of the I Ching will actually tell you if you have the changing line here, here is a more specific meaning of that hexagram. Is everyone with me? I recommend you try it. It's slow because it involves reading, but if you follow the steps, it just takes you right through it. Where you have more than one changing line, or two rather, the upper one is more important, and there are different interpretations of that. But you have a sort of nesting level of emphasis where you have the initial hexagram, but then you also have the hexagram it changes into, and then whichever lines have the emphasis. Because again, each of those individual lines, the hexagram itself has a meaning, each emphasized line has an elaboration where the raw hexagram may be very positive or very negative, or may seem that way, but the changing hexagram, the changing line that has the emphasis placed on it, may actually invert that or change the nature of the initial oracle. Some people, incredibly, which just takes work, it's not incredible, it's just worth doing, but some people have the hexagrams memorized and it's absolutely worth it. Because something they describe, and this touches back on what I said about not reading if I think it's going to tell me what I don't want to hear, which is the wrong approach to have, but we're all human. You may learn or gain the ability to do what's called knowing the scene, which is to see where something is going. It's a lot easier if you've already read the I Ching, or if you know all the lines, or if you know all the hexagrams. But this is equally true of the tarot, where as you start to read, you can tell what that trajectory is telling you. It will come because you will have learned to speak that language. In the case of the tarot, that voice I've described is, to me, softer, more fluid, and there's a degree of fancy, I think, in the nature of the symbols and the rich symbolism. Whereas in the I Ching, I find that voice to be very firm, very clear, even amongst the difficult language of the actual I Ching itself, or at least the Willimane's version. But that's how you begin to find the right tool for your given situation, whether you are attracted to that voice in the first place, or whether you find it sufficient to stay with the voice of the tarot. But one way or another, with time, you can learn to know the seeds of that oracle and begin speaking with it. And then finally, this will be a quick one. We have geomancy. Much like the tarot, geomancy has been practiced within the what we can call the Western Hermetic tradition for a long time. It was popular amongst Renaissance magicians through the 20th century, and it has very similar correspondences to the tarot. In fact, it has elemental, planetary, astrological correspondences. And in fact, for anyone who also likes or knows about astrology, there's a very direct way, and I'll show you, to read geomancy onto an astrological chart. And if you know what the planets and the elements all mean already, whether that's tarot or geomancy, you'll have the benefit. It'll save you the work of learning that symbolism in the first place. Unlike tarot, however, you don't need a deck of cards. You compute a set of figures, one figure or more, based off of one or two dots. So that could be one dot, two, one, one. Four lines, one or two dots each. And this necessarily creates 16 figures, four variations of four lines. Those 16 figures, again, all have primary correspondences, and they also have names, which I'm not going to give you, because you can find nice tables online. But you can choose to read just a single figure. The easiest way to find out, is it, you know, what's it going to be, how many dots? is you just make a set of dots and you count 3, 4, 5, 6 even. That makes it one dot. 4, another one dot. 3, 2. It's easier to do more dots because then you're not actively counting. And there are other methods. People do dots and lines. You could use fancy dice that give you the number. But one way or another, you generate some figure. Some of those figures are inherently positive. There's fortune of major fortune, usually a good thing. Then there's carcer, prison, which is usually a bad thing. And you can probably start to guess at, even just by those names, but the correspondences, what those things might mean in a certain context. Major fortune is probably going to be fortunate to whatever it is you're asking about. Carcer, prison, might represent some, not inhibition, but some limitation. Or a position of stasis that you may not necessarily want to be in. So at its simplest, you could just create a single figure. But often, and this is I think also true of the tarot, and this is a benefit to reading longer spreads, such as the Celtic Cross, for instance, you may want to get more detail out of your oracle. And one of the very common and historical methods of reading geomancy, or I guess reading a geomantic chart, is to chart it against the houses of the zodiac. Today we're used to the circle chart, probably, where you have all the angles and all the placements against the circle of the zodiac. You may or may not know what I'm talking about, but before we had those, we had a different sort of chart that looked like this. Creating 12 external segments. These 12 are assigned to the astrological houses, which I'm not really going to explain today, but each of those houses represents some different component or aspect of a chart, really. The first is your rising sign, if you know what that means, but it's often a primary symbol for whatever it is you're reading. There's one for relationships. You could be reading about wealth and career, and so on. But we have 12. I shouldn't speak while writing numbers. We have 12 houses. And we start typically to read this way, and you're not gonna learn it by me telling you, so just go online and read it, but I'll tell you anyway. You start by casting 4 figures, whether by you with your dots or something else, but you start with 4 of them. I've got 3 here. And these are called your mothers. You place the mothers in the first 4 segments, and then by different combinations of those mothers, you generate what they call the daughter figures and the nieces. Not too important, but you either at times add, to generate the daughters, you add all the tops, the top, or the head, the bodies, and so on. And you fill in the next set of segments. And you get the last 4, you add the first and second mother, the second and third mother, the third and fourth mother, first, second daughter, third and fourth daughter. I think that's great, but I'm not going to remember. You add them, and you get the rest, and you filled out something for 12 houses. And to cap it off, you finish by adding up to create what they call 2 witnesses and the judge. That judge is your primary answer. That's the judgment of your question. Actually, very similar language to the Will of Mains and Jing. And in a sense, similar in that we have this set of 4, and we have these figures that we actually calculate, in a sense. The judge is your basic answer. And from there, you look at the witnesses to give you some information about that basic judgment. Then you will turn to the figures in the individual houses. And these could be repeating, as in you could have the same figures popping up in different places, or it could be all 16, potential 12, 15 out of 16. You look to the first house, that will be very core to whatever it is you're reading. But then if you wanted to know about a career choice or a relationship, you would look to the particular house where that figure is. So a given figure in the house of the career, it will tell you, when you look at your judgment, in line with that. I wasn't probably in line with the first house too, to get some answer about that nature. That's easy, and you can stop there if you want to. I think it's better to take the extra step to read all of the houses. First, because you might get a favorable reading in the specific house that your question relates to. So it might say, yeah, go get that job, or whatever it is, or date that person. But then by reading the other houses, you might see that, well, yes, I will get that job, but wait a second, this is going to wreak havoc on my relationship. This might throw my house out of order, or whatever else it may be. And so by getting this full read, and by actually taking the time to look at it, first of all, you also get a chance to learn and memorize more of the figures. But you also get a chance to see the full picture of where that decision, or where that certain trajectory may be leading you. And you can add in additional some details, such as looking at repeated figures. So if the same figure shows up in five of these segments, especially important ones to you in that moment, that's going to have emphasis. And in a very similar way to reading the tarot as a relationship between the cards, that it's not just a set of isolated cards with true, admittedly, individual meanings, but also relationships and a story amongst them when they're side by side. And we get a very similar thing. And it's not very surprising that geomancy and tarot share the same genealogy to a large degree, or have been used historically by the same people and the same kinds of people, because they share the same symbol set. And so the readings, I would guess, evolved naturally to share similarities. That's all I have on geomancy, I think. It's a bit laborious, admittedly, as a teaching, but they are worth trying, because also while just reading, and much like the tarot, you immerse yourself in symbolism. And you immerse yourself into new perspectives on the world, and new language to get answers for. So all of this should be just an absolute baseline to be enough to go and actually try to read some things yourself. There are endless guides online, and I pointed out some of the good resources to look at for the tarot, aside from just learning the Hermetic Kabbalah. The Book of Thoth is excellent. And even that little booklet that your tarot deck comes from with is also helpful. There's no shame in reading that. There's no shame in looking up a card if you don't know. Or if you do know a card, there's no shame in looking it up anyway to see if there's something you might be missing in that moment. And you'll be drawn to appreciate the different voices. You will find some voices help you again in different reasons. But ultimately, the point, I think, is to experiment to see if, first of all, as we said in the beginning, you can actually get that value, wherever it's coming from. And you might even want to ask the oracle, where is this information coming from? But you will have a tool, by any of these or all of them, to find some guidance, to find some way to interpret, and to have an object to meditate upon to assist yourself in doing your work, whatever that is. To the magician, or at least to my kind of magician, that's the work of attainment, of self-knowledge, and all sorts of other wonderful things. So that can be a very simple way to get guidance as you move in the world, magically or otherwise. And I think just to close, you can add onto these things as much as you want. You can just read, but if you want to make these more magical, you can banish before. You can invoke a particular spirit to answer you. You can do meditation, or just light some incense and create a ritual out of it. And those things are not strictly necessary, but they are helpful. They do add a level of intention, a level of ceremony, which I believe, in fact, imbues that work with more power to help you get to what you want to achieve. With that, I see we draw a few cards, and we can talk it through to see what we think about the relationships. Would anybody like to volunteer a question? can be anything. It can be about yourself, it can be about us, it can be about me. And if you don't have one, I'll come up with something. Back to school in a few months. And I might want to know, before I take the step of moving away, quitting my job, shifting my life pretty drastically, what kind of challenges will I face? Easy, simple question. I'm not even necessarily looking for advice, although I may find that the cards give me some advice. Reading tarot, I'll shuffle. I'm sure people have different preferences for how much to shuffle. I shuffle until it feels right. Does it feel right?
You feel right.
And I'll draw one. I'll pick them up for you. Don't worry. Two. Three. This one's upside down. These are big, but I know everyone's far away. We start with a 5 of discs. Subtitled, worry. So without even bringing in the Kabbalah, worry is not a good place to start. What challenges am I going to face going back to school? I feel a little worried about that, don't I? If I'm asking the tarot, I think it's reasonable to assume this might be where I'm starting now, or at least one of the challenges may very well be simply worrying about success. That's my interpretation, and that may not be yours. Pulling in the Kabbalah, we have 5, Gevurah. That's the sphere here, which, among other things, is associated to Mars. A lot of the 5 cards in this deck are quite negative, because Mars is a difficult planet, often, or it can be. And what we have, given that this is discs, we have Mars, or Gevurah, rather, in the manifest world, on the earth. I'm going to be broke. I'm not going to work. 100% of my spending for the next 3 years will be on debt. And my school will be expensive. And I'll be paying for rent. And so I could reasonably assume that something that may worry me, aside from just starting this new step, will be affording it. Or spending money like I have a job. Or paying it all back when I'm done. Aside from just those correspondences, we have, you can't see from here, you'll see Mercury and Taurus. And so you can add in that extra step. Not all the tarot decks should quite historically have those, but I also find them very valuable to think about what that might represent. Very quickly, and actually I'm probably a quite weak astrologer, Mercury and Taurus, and Mercury I think of luck to a degree, wealth, but of change in the mind, and Taurus is in the great earth being uncomfortable. And so perhaps maybe either change or concern or thinking about my own level of comfort. Easy, quick. Moving from worry, we have sorrow. Excellent outlook for me. The imagery of the card itself is quite negative, and it tells us a few things. This is the 3 of Swords. Swords, for those of us who recall, represent the mind, the air. And 3, being the third sphere, Bina, is attributed, among other things, to Saturn. So we think limitation, form, and to a degree, what I just called upon. Having no money, potentially having no time, I'll be busy. Not enjoy the same creature comforts that I may have, I might be, the swords may well be a manifestation, a rationalization, the activity of thought about my circumstances. Saturn, of course, is lead, it's the heaviest and the most earthly of the planets, well, the heaviest of the planets, I will say. And so it may well be applying the mind to something of the earth. And I would argue improperly. And so it may not simply be that my mind's going to have a bad time, but this may be and I would interpret it to be a guidance to say, if I apply my thoughts and let them run in this place of form, in this place of limitation, I'm going to have a bad time, and that will lead to sorrow. And this tells us Saturn, you can't see from there, in Libra. Again, not a great astrologer. But we have that conflict of Saturn, which is very heavy, and Libra, which is an air sign. To me, echoing the relationship between the three and the swords. Does anybody want to try the Knight of Cups, which is reversed? That's how it looks upright. I didn't touch on reverse cards. Some people like to use them, which is that as you use the deck, sometimes cards get flipped around. So people often, I do as well, will treat the reverse as a reversal of its meaning. A card which may mean worry when it's upright may be the opposite of worry when it's reversed, and so on. This is a bit harder for you guys because those two were number cards. This is a court card. So I'll help in the correspondences, and we'll see if we can get a bit of analysis. The knight is the fire. It represents the kind of father figure of the elements. And we can see this as drive, in a sense, our will, whatever that may be. Cups is emotions, water, the subconscious, but I like the emotions in this case. And reversal, whatever that message is. The upright nature of the card, in my opinion, we see the rider on a Pegasus of sorts, grasping a golden chalice. The Holy Grail, most likely. It is. Achieving some, I would argue, it's a drive, it's normal placement, a drive towards an emotional goal, so emotional grail. And so reversed, do we have any ideas for what this might mean? What is the inversion of a drive towards an emotional fulfillment? Could be. A lack of? Potentially, right? Because if that grail is, there is that thing that's going to make it for us, that objective, if we're reversing it, we're actually not potentially driving towards something that will be emotionally fulfilling or that will help us self-actualize. We'll go to the context of the three cards, where we have that beginning place of worry, something quite material, that area of mental sorrow, that leaden mind, leading into a reversal of the goal, or the reversal of emotional fulfillment, or at least the drive towards it. Remembering what challenges am I going to face entering school. Be worried, probably about my circumstances. That will make me unhappy, and if that makes me unhappy, then what? But I think I might lose sight of that goal, potentially. And knowing this, that might tell me, first of all, to try and do that worry in the first place, I might say, well, don't worry, and that actually might help me avoid it, because I would read it's not the decision that will make me, that will lead to me losing sight of my goal, but it may be the stress over it, the concern, the anxiety that will make me lose sight. And that if I let myself be in that space, if I let my mind be in that letting space, then I might lose sight of what it is that I want. That could be what it is, the reason why I went to school, that could be anything else. And so sometimes I like to draw one more card, and mentioned this before, as a clarification and as a goal. Here I've drawn the star. This is a nice counterpoint because we have number cards with a court card. Now this is one of the trumps. And to me, very simply, not very simply, but among other things, the star actually is that goal. It's that driving force. It's not necessarily getting the grail like Mr. Horseman right there. but it's the guiding star in the sky that reminds me of where it is I'm going, or I'd like to be going. And in this case, that would be the clarification, which is, I may not be getting the Grail, or I might be jeopardizing it by letting my mind get in the way of my objective, or my fulfillment or actualization. But in keeping sight of the star, in keeping sight of what I want, potentially what I'm going to school, and so on and so forth, I might have my way through. That's it for me. You can, you might pass around the deck if you'd like to. Feel free to look at cards, comment upon them, give it a shuffle, and at some point we'll just do a more open read for the group where I will stop up. And thank you. Love is Allah, love and good.
Thanks for listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.